17. Sure, there's a police computer forensic squad, Hodges says in answer to Holly's question. If you want to call three part-time crunchers a squad, that is. And no, they won't listen to me. I'm just a civilian these days. Nor is that the worst of it. He's a civilian who used to be a cop. And when retired cops try meddling in police business, they are called uncles. It is not a term of respect.
Then call Pete and have him do it, Holly says, because that fracking suicide site has to come down.
The two of them are back in Freddy Linklater's version of Mission Control. Jerome is in the living room with Freddy. Hodges doesn't think she's apt to flee. Freddy's terrified of the probably fictional men posted outside her building. But stoner behavior is difficult to predict, other than how they usually want to get more stoned, that is.
Call Pete and tell him to have one of the computer geeks call me. Any cruncher with half a brain will be able to DOS the site and knock it down that way.
DOS it?
Big D, little O, big S stands for denial of services. The guy needs to connect to a bot network and...
She sees Hodges' mystified expression.
Never mind. The idea is to flood the suicide site with requests for services. Thousands, millions, choke the fracking thing and crash the server.
You can do that?
I can't, and Freddy can't. But a police department geek freak will be able to tap enough computing power. If he can't do it from the police computers, he'll get Homeland Security to do it. Because this is a security issue, right? Lives are at stake.
They are, and Hodges makes the call. But Pete's cell goes directly to voicemail. Next, he tries his old pal Cassie Sheen, but the desk officer who takes his call tells him Cassie's mother had some sort of diabetic crisis, and Cassie took her to the doctor. Out of other options, he calls Isabel. Izzy? It's Bill Hodges. I tried to get Pete, but...
Pete's gone. Done. Kaput.
For one awful moment, Hodges thinks she means he's dead.
Left a memo on my desk. It said he was going to go home, turn off his cell, pull the plug on the landline, and sleep for the next 24 hours. He further shared that today was his last day as working police. He can do it, too. Doesn't even have to touch his vacation time, of which he has piles. He's got enough personal days to see him through to retirement. And I think you better scratch that retirement party off your calendar. You and your weirdo partner can hit a movie that night instead.
You're blaming me?
You and your Brady Hartsfield fixation. You infected Pete with it.
No. He wanted to chase the case. You were the one who wanted to hand it off, then duck down in the nearest foxhole. Gotta say, I'm kind of on Pete's side when it comes to that one.
See? See? That's exactly the attitude I'm talking about. Wake up, Hodges. This is the real world. I'm telling you for the last time to quit sticking your long beak into what isn't your business.
And I'm telling you that if you want to have any fucking chance of promotion, you need to get your head out of your ass and listen to me. The words are out before he can think better of them. He's afraid she'll hang up, and if she does, where will he go then? But there's only shocked silence. Suicides. Have any been reported since you got back from Sugar Heights?
I don't know.
Well, look. Right now. He can hear the faint tapping of Izzy's keyboard for 5 seconds or so.
Then, one just came over the wire. Kid in Lakewood shot himself. Did it in front of his father, who called it in. Hysterical, as you might expect. What's that got to do with...
Tell the cops on the scene to look for a Zap-It game console, just like the one Holly found at the Ellerton house.
That again? You're like a broken wreck.
They'll find one. And you may have more Zap-It suicides before the day's over. Possibly a lot more.
Website, Holly mouths. Tell her about the website.
Also, there's a suicide website called Z The End. Just went up today. It needs to come down.
She sighs and speaks as though to a child. There are all kinds of suicide websites. We got a memo about it from Juvenile Services just last year. They pop up on the net like mushrooms, usually created by kids who wear black t-shirts and spend all their free time holed up in their bedrooms. There's a lot of bad poetry and stuff about how to do it painlessly, along with the usual bitching about how their parents don't understand them, of course.
This one is different. It could start an avalanche. It's loaded with subliminal messages. Have someone from computer forensics call Holly Gibney ASAP.
That would be outside of protocol, she says coolly. I'll have a look, then go through channels.
Have one of your renegades call Holly in the next 5 minutes, or when the suicides start cascading, and I'm pretty sure they will. I'll make it clear to anyone who'll listen that I went to you and you tied me up in red tape. My listeners will include the Daily Paper and 8 Alive. The department does not have a lot of friends in either place, especially since those two unis shot an unarmed black kid to death on MLK last summer.
Silence. Then, in a softer voice, a hurt voice maybe, she says, "You're supposed to be on our side, Billy. Why are you acting this way?"
"Because Holly was right about you," he thinks. Out loud, he says, "because there isn't much time."
18. In the living room, Freddie is rolling another joint. She looks at Jerome over the top of it as she licks the paper closed. "You're a big one, aren't you?"
Jerome makes no reply.
"What do you go? 210? 220?
Jerome has nothing to say to this, either.
Undeterred, she sparks the joint, inhales, and holds it out to him. Jerome shakes his head. "You're lost, big boy. This is pretty good shit. Smells like dog pee, I know, but pretty good shit, just the same."
Jerome says nothing.
"Cat got your tongue?"
"No.
I was thinking about a sociology class I took when I was a high school senior. We did a 4-week mod on suicide, and there was one statistic I never forgot. Every teen suicide that makes it onto social media spawns 7 attempts. 5 that are show, and 2 that are go. Maybe you should think about that instead of running the tough girl act into the ground." Freddie's lower lip trembles.
"I didn't know. Not really."
"Sure you did." She drops her eyes to the joint. It's her turn to say nothing. "My sister heard a voice." At that, Freddie looks up.
"What kind of voice?"
"One from the Zappit. It told her all sorts of mean things. About how she was trying to live white. About how she was denying her race. About how she was a bad and worthless person."
"And that reminds you of someone?"
"Yes." Jerome is thinking of the accusatory shrieks he and Holly heard coming from Olivia Trelawney's computer long after that unfortunate lady was dead. Shrieks programmed by Brady Hartsfield and designed to drive Trelawney towards suicide like a cow down a slaughterhouse chute. Actually, it does.
"Brady was fascinated by suicide," Freddie says. "He was always reading about it on the web. He meant to kill himself with the others at that concert, you know."
Jerome does know. He was there. "Do you really think he got in touch with my sister telepathically? Using the Zappit as, what, a kind of conduit?"
"If he could take over Babineau and the other guy, and he did, whether you believe it or not, then yeah, I think he could do that."
"And the others with updated Zappits? Those 240-something others?" Freddie only looks at him through her veil of smoke. "Even if we take down the website, what about them? What about when that voice starts telling them they're dog shit on the world's shoe, and the only answer is to take a long walk off a short dock?" Before she can reply, Hodges does it for her.
"We have to stop the voice, which means stopping him. Come on, Jerome, we're going back to the office."
"What about me?"
Freddie asks plaintively. "You're coming. And Freddie?"
"What?"
"Pot's good for pain, isn't it?"
"Opinions on that vary, as you might guess. The establishment in this fucked up country being what it is, so all I can tell you is that for me, it makes that delicate time of the month a lot less delicate."
"Bring it along," Hodges says. "Also the rolling papers."
19. They go back to Finders Keepers in Jerome's Jeep. The back is full of Jerome's junk, meaning Freddie has to sit on someone's lap, and it's not going to be Hodges, not in his current condition. So he drives, and Jerome gets Freddie.
"Hey, this is sort of like getting a date with John Shaft,"
Freddy says with a smirk. The big private dick who's a sex machine to all the chicks. Don't get used to it, Jerome says. Holly's cell rings. It's a guy named Trevor Jepson from the police department's computer forensic squad. Holly is soon speaking in a jargon Hodges doesn't understand, something about bots and the darknet. Whatever she's getting back from the guy seems to please her because when she breaks the connection, she's smiling.
He's never DOSed a website before. He's like a kid on Christmas morning.
How long will it take?
With the password and the IP address already in hand, not long.
Hodges parks in one of the 30-minute spaces in front of the Turner building. They won't be here long, if he gets lucky, that is, and given his recent run of bad luck, he considers the universe owes him a good turn.
He goes into his office, closes the door, then hunts through his ratty old address book for Becky Helmington's number. Holly has offered to program the address book into his phone, but Hodges has kept putting it off. He likes his old address book. Probably never get around to making the changeover now, he thinks. Trent's last case and all that. Becky reminds him she doesn't work in the bucket any longer.
Maybe you forgot that?
I didn't forget. You know about Babineau? Her voice drops.
God, yes. I heard that Al Brooks, Library Al, killed Babineau's wife and might have killed him. I can hardly believe it.
I could tell you lots of stuff you'd hardly believe, Hodges thinks. Don't count Babineau out yet, Becky. I think he might be on the run. He was giving Brady Hartsfield experimental drugs of some kind, and they may have played a part in Hartsfield's death.
Jesus, for real?
For real. But he can't be too far, not with this storm coming in. Can you think of any place he might have gone? Does Babineau own a summer cottage, anything like that?
She doesn't even need to think about it.
Not a cottage. A hunting camp. It isn't just him, though. Four or maybe five docs co-own the place.
Her voice drops to that confidential pitch again.
I hear they do more than hunt out there, if you know what I mean.
Where is out there?
Lake Charles. The camp has some cutesy, horrible name. I can't remember it offhand, but I bet Violet Tran would know. She spent a weekend there once. Said it was the drunkest 48 hours of her life, and she came back with chlamydia.
Will you call her?
Sure, but if he's on the run, he might be on a plane, you know. Maybe to California or even overseas. The flights were still taking off and landing this morning.
I don't think he would have dared to try the airport with the police looking for him. Thanks, Becky. Call me back.
He goes to the safe and punches in the combination. The sock filled with ball bearings, his happy slapper, is back home. But both of his handguns are here. One is the Glock 40 he carried on the job. The other is a 38, the Victory model. It was his father's. He takes a canvas sack from the top shelf of the safe, puts the guns and four boxes of ammunition into it, then gives the drawstring a hard yank.
No heart attack to stop me this time, Brady, he thinks. This time it's just cancer, and I can live with that. The idea surprises him into laughter. It hurts. From the other room comes the sound of three people applauding. Hodges is pretty sure he knows what it means, and he's not wrong. The message on Holly's computer reads, Z, the end, is experiencing technical difficulties. Below is this. Call 1-800-273-TALK.
It was that guy Jepson's idea,
Holly says, not looking up from what she's doing.
It's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline.
Good one, Hodges says. And those are good, too. You're a woman with hidden talents.
In front of Holly is a line of joints. The one she adds makes an even dozen.
She's fast, Freddy says admiringly. And look how neat they are, like they came out of a machine.
Holly gives Hodges a defiant look.
My therapist says an occasional marijuana cigarette is perfectly okay. As long as I don't go overboard, that is, the way some people do.
Her eyes glide to Freddy, then back to Hodges.
Besides, these aren't for me. They're for you, Bill, if you need them.
Hodges thanks her and has a moment to reflect on how far the two of them have come and how pleasant, by and large, the trip has been. But too short. Far too short. Then his phone rings. It's Becky. The name of the place is Heads and Skins. I told you it was cutesy horrible. Vi doesn't remember how to get there. I'm guessing she had more than a few shots on the ride just to get her motor running. But she does remember they went north on the turnpike for quite a ways and stopped for gas at a place called Thurston's Garage after they got off. Does that help?
Yeah, a ton. Thanks, Becky. He ends the call. Holly, I need you to find Thurston's Garage north of the city. Then I want you to call Hertz at the airport and rent the biggest four-wheel drive they've got left. We're going on a road trip. My Jeep, Jerome begins, is small, light, and old, Hodges says. Although these are not the only reasons he wants a different vehicle built to go in the snow. It'll be fine to get us out to the airport, though.
What about me?
Freddy asks. Which sec, Hodges says, as promised. It'll be like a dream come true.
20. Jane Ellsbury was a perfectly normal baby. At 6 pounds 9 ounces, a little underweight, in fact. But by the time she was 7, she weighed 90 pounds and was familiar with the chant that sometimes haunts her dreams to this day. Fatty, fatty, 2x4, can't get through the bathroom door, so she does it on the floor. In June of 2010, when her mother took her to the Round Here concert as a 15th birthday present, she weighed 210. She could still get through the bathroom door with no problem, but it had become difficult for her to tie her shoes. Now, she's 20. Her weight has risen to 320. And when the voice begins to speak to her from the free Zap-It she got in the mail, everything it says makes perfect sense to her. The voice is low, calm, and reasonable. It tells her that nobody likes her, and everybody laughs at her. It points out that she can't stop eating. Even now, with tears running down her face, she's snarfing her way through a bag of chocolate pinwheel cookies, the kind with lots of gooey marshmallow inside. Like a more kindly version of the ghost of Christmas yet to come, who pointed out certain home truths to Ebenezer Scrooge, it sketches in a future which boils down to fat, fatter, fattest. The laughter along Carbine Street in hillbilly heaven where she and her parents live in a walk-up apartment. The looks of disgust. The jibes like, here comes the Goodyear blimp, and look out, don't let her fall on you. The voice explains, logically and reasonably, that she will never have a date, will never be hired for a good job now that political correctness has rendered the circus fat lady extinct, that by the age of 40 she will have to sleep sitting up because her enormous breasts will make it impossible for her lungs to do their work, and before she dies of a heart attack at 50, she'll be using a dustbuster to get the crumbs out of the deepest creases in her rolls of fat. When she tries to suggest to the voice that she could lose some weight, go to one of those clinics, maybe, it doesn't laugh. It only asks her, softly and sympathetically, where the money will come from when the combined incomes of her mother and father are barely enough to satisfy an appetite that is basically insatiable. When the voice suggests they'd be better off without her, she can only agree. Jane, known to the denizens of Carbine Street as Fat Jane, lumbers into the bathroom and takes the bottle of OxyContin pills her father has for his bad back. She counts them. There are 30, which should be more than enough. She takes them 5 at a time with milk, eating a chocolate marshmallow cookie after each swallow. She begins to float away. I'm going on a diet, she thinks. I'm going on a long, long diet. That's right, the voice from the Zap-It tells her, and you'll never cheat on this one, Jane, will you? She takes the last 5 oxys. She tries to pick up the Zap-It, but her fingers will no longer close on the slim console. And what does it matter? She could never catch the speedy pink fish in this condition anyway. Better to look out the window where the snow is bearing the world in clean linen. No more fatty, fatty 2x4, she thinks, and when she slips into unconsciousness, she goes with relief.
21. Before going to Hertz, Hodges swings Jerome's Jeep into the turnaround in front of the Airport Hilton.
This is supposed to be witness protection?
Freddie asks.
This?
Hodges says, since I don't happen to have a safe house at my disposal, it will have to do. I'll register you under my name. You go in, you lock the door, you watch TV, you wait until this thing is over.
And change the dressing on that wound,
Holly says. Freddie ignores her. She's focused on Hodges.
How much trouble am I going to be in when it's over?
I don't know, and I don't have time to discuss it with you now.
Can I at least order room service?
There's a faint gleam in Freddie's bloodshot eyes.
I'm not in so much pain now, and I've got a wicked case of the munchies.
Knock yourself out, Hodges says. Jerome adds,
only check the peephole before you let in the waiter. Make sure it isn't one of Brady Hartsfield's men in black.
You're kidding, Freddie says. Right?
The hotel lobby is dead empty on this snowy afternoon. Hodges, who feels as if he woke up to Pete's telephone call approximately 3 years ago, walks to the desk, does his business there, and comes back to where the others are sitting. Holly is tapping away at something on her iPad and doesn't look up. Freddie holds out her hand for the key folder, but Hodges gives it to Jerome instead. Room 522. Take her up, will you? I want to talk to Holly. Jerome raises his eyebrows, and when Hodges doesn't elaborate, he shrugs and takes Freddie by the arm.
John Shaft will now escort you to your suite.
She pushes his hand away.
Be lucky if it even has a minibar.
But she gets up and walks with him toward the elevators.
I found Thurston's garage,
Holly says.
It's 56 miles north on I-47. The direction the storm's coming from, unfortunately. After that, it's State Road 79. The weather really doesn't look good.
We'll be okay, Hodges says. Hertz is holding a Ford Expedition for us. It's a nice, heavy vehicle, and you can give me the turn-by-turn later. I want to talk to you about something else. Gently, he takes her iPad and turns it off. Holly looks at him with her hands clasped in her lap, waiting.
22. Brady comes back from Carbine Street in Hillbilly Heaven, refreshed and exhilarated. The Ellsbury fatso was both easy and fun. He wonders how many guys it will take to get her body down from that third-floor apartment. He's guessing at least 4. And think of the coffin! Jumbo size! When he checks the website and finds it offline, his good mood collapses again. Yes, he expected Hodges would find a way to kill it, but he didn't expect it to happen so fast. And the phone number on the screen is as infuriating as the fuck you messages Hodges left on Debbie's blue umbrella during their first go-round. It's a suicide prevention hotline. He doesn't even have to check. He knows. And yes, Hodges will come. Plenty of people at Kiner Memorial know about this place. It's sort of legendary. But will he come straight in? Brady doesn't believe that for a minute. For one thing, the debt ret will know that many hunters leave their firearms out at camp, although few are as fully stocked with them as heads and skins. For another, and this is more important, the debt ret is one sly hyena. 6 years older than when Brady first encountered him, true, undoubtedly shorter of wind and shakier of limb, but sly. The sort of slinking animal that doesn't come at you directly but goes for the hamstrings while you're looking elsewhere. So, I'm Hodges. What do I do? After giving this due consideration, Brady goes to the closet, and a brief check of Babineau's memory, what's left of it, is all it takes for him to choose outerwear that belongs to the body he's inhabiting. Everything fits perfectly. He adds a pair of gloves to protect his arthritic fingers and goes outside. The snow is only a moderate fall, and the branches of the trees are still. All that will change later, but for now, it's pleasant enough to go for a tramp around the property. He walks to a woodpile, whose surface is covered with an old canvas tarp and a few inches of fresh powder. Beyond it are 2 or 3 acres of old-growth pines and spruces separating heads and skins from Big Bob's bear camp. It's perfect. He needs to visit the gun closet. The scar is fine, but there are other things in there he can use. Oh, Detective Hodges, Brady thinks, hurrying back the way he came. I've got such a surprise. Such a surprise for you. 23. Jerome listens carefully to what Hodges tells him, then shakes his head. No way, Bill. I need to come. What you need to do is go home and be with your family, Hodges says. You especially need to be with your sister. She had a close call yesterday. They are sitting in a corner of the Hilton's reception area, speaking in low voices, although even the desk clerk has retired to the nether regions. Jerome is leaning forward, hands planted on his thighs, his face set in a stubborn frown. If Holly's going,
it's different for us, Holly says. You must see that, Jerome. I don't get along with my mother. Never have. I see her once or twice a year at most. I'm always glad to leave, and I'm sure she's glad to see me go. As for Bill, you know he'll fight what he's got, but both of us know what the chances are. Your case is not like ours.
He's dangerous, Hodges says, and we can't count on the element of surprise. If he doesn't know I'll come for him, he's stupid. That's one thing he never was.
It was the three of us at the Mingo, Jerome says, and after you went into vapor lock, it was just Holly and me. We did okay.
Last time was different, Holly says. Last time, he wasn't capable of mind control juju.
I still want to come.
Hodges nods. I understand, but I'm still the wheel dog, and the wheel dog says no.
But there's another reason, Holly says. A bigger reason. The repeater's offline, and the website's shut down. But that leaves almost 250 active Zabbits. There's been at least one suicide already, and we can't tell the police all of what's going on. Isabel Janes thinks Bill's a meddler, and anyone else would think we're crazy. If anything happens to us, there's only you. Don't you understand that?
What I understand is that you're cutting me out, Jerome says.
All at once he sounds like the weedy young kid Hodges hired to mow his lawn all those years ago. There's more, Hodges says. I might have to kill him. In fact, I think that's the most likely outcome.
Jesus, Bill, I know that.
But to the cops and the world at large, the man I killed would be a respected neurosurgeon named Felix Babineau. I've wiggled out of some tight legal corners since opening Finders Keepers, but this one could be different. Do you want to risk being charged as an accessory to aggravated manslaughter, defined in this state as the reckless killing of a human being through culpable negligence? Maybe even murder one?
Jerome squirms. You're willing to let Holly risk that?
Holly says, you're the one with most of your life still ahead of you.
Hodges leans forward, even though it hurts to do so, and cups the broad nape of Jerome's neck. I know you don't like it. I didn't expect you would, but it's the right thing for all the right reasons.
Jerome thinks it over and sighs. I see your point.
Hodges and Holly wait, both of them knowing this is not quite good enough.
Okay, Jerome says at last. I hate it, but okay.
Hodges gets up, hand to his side to hold in the pain. Then let's snag that SUV. The storm's coming, and I'd like to get as far up I-47 as possible before we meet it.
24.
Jerome is leaning against the hood of his Wrangler when they come out of the rental office with the keys to an all-wheel drive Expedition. He hugs Holly and whispers in her ear,
"Last chance. Take me along."
She shakes her head against his chest. He lets her go and turns to Hodges, who's wearing an old fedora, the brim already white with snow.
Hodges puts out a hand. Under other circumstances, I'd go with the hug, but right now hugs hurt.
Jerome settles for a strong grip.
There are tears in his eyes. Be careful, man. Stay in touch, and bring back the hollyberry. I intend to do that, Hodges says. Jerome watches them get into the expedition, Bill climbing behind the wheel with obvious discomfort. Jerome knows they're right. Of the three of them, he's the least expendable. That doesn't mean he likes it, or feels less like a little kid being sent home to mommy. He would go after them, he thinks, except for the thing Holly said in that deserted hotel lobby. If anything happens to us, there's only you. Jerome gets into his Jeep and heads home. As he merges onto the crosstown, a strong premonition comes to him. He's never going to see either one of his friends again. He tries to tell himself that superstitious bullshit, but he can't quite make it work. 25. By the time Hodges and Holly leave the crosstown for I-47 North, the snow is no longer just kidding around. Driving into it reminds Hodges of a science fiction movie he saw with Holly, the moment when the starship Enterprise goes into hyperdrive or whatever they call it. The speed limit signs are flashing snow alert and 40 miles per hour, but he pegs the speedometer at 60 and will hold it there as long as he can, which might be for 30 miles. Perhaps only 20. A few cars in the travel lane honk at him to slow down, and passing the lumbering 18-wheelers, each one dragging a rooster-tail fog of snow behind it, is an exercise in controlled fear. It's almost half an hour before Holly breaks the silence.
You brought the guns, didn't you? That's what's in the drawstring bag?
Yeah. She unbuckles her seatbelt, which makes him nervous, and fishes the bag out of the back seat.
Are they loaded?
The Glock is. The 38 you'll have to load it yourself. That one's yours.
I don't know how.
Hodges offered to take her to the shooting range with him once, start the process of getting her qualified to carry concealed, but she refused vehemently. He never offered again, believing she would never need to carry a gun, believing he would never put her in that position. You'll figure it out. It's not hard. She examines the Victory, keeping her hands well away from the trigger and the muzzle well away from her face. After a few seconds, she succeeds in rolling the barrel. Okay. Now the bullets. There are two boxes of Winchester 38s, 130 grain, full metal jacket. She opens one, looks at the shells sticking up like mini warheads, and grimaces. Oof. Can you do it? He's passing another truck, the expedition enveloped in snow fog. There are still strips of bare pavement in the travel lane, but this passing lane is now snow-covered, and the truck on their right seems to go on forever. If you can't, that's okay.
You don't mean, can I load it? She says, sounding angry. I see how to do that. A kid could do it.
Sometimes they do, Hodges thinks.
What you mean is, can I shoot him?
It probably won't come to that, but if it did, could you?
Yes, Holly says, and loads the Victory's six chambers. She pushes the cylinder back into place gingerly, lips turned down and eyes squinted into slits, as if afraid the gun will explode in her hand. Now, where's the safety switch?
There isn't any. Not on revolvers. The hammer's down, and that's all the safety that you need. Put it in your purse, the ammo, too. She does as he says, then places the bag between her feet. And stop biting your lips. You're going to make them bleed.
I'll try. But this is a very stressful situation, Bill.
I know. They're back in the travel lane again. The mile markers seem to float past with excruciating slowness, and the pain in his side is a hot jellyfish with long tentacles that now seem to reach everywhere, even up into his throat. Once, 20 years ago, he was shot in the leg by a thief cornered in a vacant lot. That pain had been like this, but eventually it had gone away. He doesn't think this one ever will. The drugs may mute it for a while, but probably not for long.
What if we find this place and he's not there, Bill? Have you thought about that? Have you?
He has, and has no idea what the next step would be in that case. Let's not worry about it unless we have to. His phone rings. It's in his coat pocket, and he hands it to Holly without looking away from the road ahead.
Hello. This is Holly.
She listens,
then mouths,
"Miss Pretty Gray Eyes,"
to Hodges.
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay, I understand. No, he can't. His hands are full right now. But I'll tell him.
She listens some more, then says,
"I could tell you, Izzy, but you wouldn't believe me."
She closes his phone with a snap and slips it back into his pocket.
"Suicides?" Hodges asks.
3 so far, counting the boy who shot himself in front of his father.
Zappets?
At 2 of the 3 locations. Responders at the 3rd one haven't had a chance to look. They were trying to save the kid, but it was too late. He hung himself. Izzy sounds half out of her mind. She wanted to know everything.
If anything happens to us, Jerome will tell Pete, and Pete will tell her. I think she's almost ready to listen.
We have to stop him before he kills more.
He's probably killing more right now, Hodges thinks. We will. The miles roll by. Hodges is forced to reduce his speed to 50, and when he feels the expedition do a loose little shimmy in the slipstream of a Walmart double box, he drops to 45. It's past 3 o'clock, and the light is starting to drain from this snowy day when Holly speaks again.
Thank you.
He turns his head briefly, looking a question at her.
For not making me beg to come along.
I'm only doing what your therapist would want, Hodges says, getting you a bunch of closure.
Is that a joke? I can never tell when you're joking. You have an extremely dry sense of humor, Bill.
No joke. This is our business, Holly, nobody else's.
A green sign looms out of the white murk.
SR-79, Holly says. That's our exit.
Thank God, Hodges says. I hate turnpike driving even when the sun's out.
26. Thurston's garage is 15 miles east along the state highway, according to Holly's iPad, but it takes them half an hour to get there. The expedition handles the snow-covered road easily, but now the wind is picking up. It will be blowing at gale force by 8 o'clock, according to the radio, and when it gusts, throwing sheets of snow across the road, Hodges eases down to 15 miles an hour until he can see again. As he turns in at the big yellow Shell sign, Holly's phone rings. "Handle that," he says. "I'll be as quick as I can." He gets out, yanking his fedora down hard to keep it from blowing away. The wind machine guns his coat collar against his neck as he tramps through the snow to the garage office. His entire midsection is throbbing. It feels as if he's swallowed live coals. The gas pumps in the adjacent parking area are empty except for the idling expedition. The plowboys have departed to spend a long night earning their money as the first big storm of the year rants and raves. For one eerie moment, Hodges thinks it's Library Al behind the counter. Same green dickies, same popcorn white hair exploding around the edges of his John Deere cap.
"What brings you out on a wild afternoon like this?" the old guy asks, then peers past Hodges. "Or is it night already?"
"A little of both," Hodges says. He has no time for conversation. Back in the city, kids may be jumping out of apartment building windows and swallowing pills, but it's how the job is done. "Would you be Mr. Thurston?"
"In the flesh. Since you didn't pull up at the pumps, I'd almost wonder if you came to rob me. But you look a little too prosperous for that. City fella?"
"I am," Hodges says, "and in kind of a hurry."
"City fellows usually are."
Thurston puts down the Field and Stream he's been reading.
"What is it, then? Directions? Man, I hope it's somewhere close, the way this one's shaping up."
"I think it is. A hunting camp called Heads and Skins. Ring a bell?"
"Oh, sure," Thurston says. "The doctor's place, right near Big Bob's bear camp. Those fellas usually gas up their jags and Porsches here, either on their way out or their way back."
He pronounces Porsches as if he's talking about the things old folks sit on in the evening to watch the sun go down.
"Wouldn't be nobody out there now, though. Hunting season ends December night, and I'm talking bow hunting. Gun hunting ends the last day of November, and all those docs use rifles, big ones. I think they like to pretend they're in Africa."
"Nobody stopped earlier today? Would have been driving an old car with a lot of primer on it?"
"Nope."
A young man comes out of the garage bay, wiping his hands on a rag.
I saw that car, Granddad. A Chevrolet. I was out front talking with Spider Willis when it went by.
He turns his attention to Hodges.
I only noticed because there's not much the way he was headed, and that car was no snow dog like the one you've got out there.
Can you give me directions to the camp?
Easiest thing in the world,
Thurston says.
Or would be on a fair day. You keep on going the way you were heading, about...
He turns his attention to the younger man.
What would you say, Duane? 3 miles?
More like 4,
Duane says.
Well, split the difference and call it 3.5, Thurston says. You'll be looking for 2 red posts on your left. They're tall, 6 feet or so, but the state plow's been by twice already, so you want to keep a sharp eye because there won't be much of them to see. You'll have to bull your way through the snowbank, you know, unless you brought a shovel.
I think what I'm driving will do it, Hodges says.
Yeah, most likely. And no harm to your SUV since the snow hasn't had a chance to pack down. Anyway, you go in 1 mile or maybe 2 and the road splits. One fork goes to Big Bob's, the other to Heads and Skins. Now, I can't remember which one is which, but there used to be arrow signs.
Still are,
Duane says.
Big Bob's is on the right, Heads and Skins on the left. I ought to know. I reshingled Big Bob Rowan's roof last October. This must be pretty important, mister, to get you out on a day like this.
Will my SUV make it on that road, do you think?
Sure, Duane says. Trees will still be holding up most of the snow, and the road runs downhill to the lake. Making it out might be a little trickier.
Hodges takes his wallet from his back pocket. Christ, even that hurts, and fishes out his police ID with retired stamped on it. To it he adds one of his finder's keeper's business cards and lays them both on the counter. Can you gentlemen keep a secret? They nod, faces bright with curiosity. I've got a subpoena to serve, right? It's a civil case, and the money at stake runs to 7 figures. The man you saw go by, the one in the primered-up Chevy, is a doctor named Babineau.
See him every November,
the elder Thurston says.
Got an attitude about him, you know? Like he's always seeing you from under the end of his nose. But he drives a Beamer.
Today he's driving whatever he could get his hands on, Hodges says. And if I don't serve these papers by midnight, the case goes bye-bye, and an old lady who doesn't have much won't get her payday.
Malpractice?
Duane asks. Don't like to say, but I'm going in. Which you will remember, Hodges thinks. That and Babineau's name. The old man says,
there are a couple of snowmobiles out back. I could let you have one if you want, and the Arctic Cat has a high windshield. It'd still be a chilly ride, but you'd be guaranteed getting back.
Hodges is touched by the offer, coming as it does to a complete stranger, but shakes his head. Snowmobiles are noisy beasts. He has an idea that the man now in residence at Heads and Skins, be he Brady or Babineau or a weird mixture of the two, knows he's coming. What Hodges has on his side is that his quarry doesn't know when. My partner and I will get in, he says, and worry about getting out later.
Nice and quiet, huh?
Duane says and puts a finger to his lips, which are curved in a smile. That's the ticket. Is there someone I could call for a ride if I do get stuck?
Call right here.
Thurston hands him a card from the plastic tray by the cash register.
I'll send either Duane or Spider Willis. It might not be until late tonight, and it'll cost you $40, but with a case worth millions, I guess you can afford that.
Do cell phones work out here?
5 bars even in dirty weather, Duane says. There's a tower on the south side of the lake.
Good to know. Thank you. Thank you both. He turns to go, and the old man says,
that hat you're wearing is no good in this weather. Take this.
He holds out a knit hat with a big orange pom-pom on top.
Can't do nothing about those shoes, though.
Hodges thanks him, takes the hat, then removes his fedora and puts it on the counter. It feels like bad luck. It feels like exactly the right thing to do. Collateral, he says. Both of them grin, the younger one with quite a few more teeth.
Good enough, the old man says. But are you 100% sure you want to be driving out to the lake, mister?
He glances down at the finder's keeper's business card.
Mr. Hodges? Because you look a trifle peaky.
It's a chest cold, Hodges says. I get one every damn winter. Thank you, both of you. And if Dr. Babineau should by any chance call here?
Wouldn't give him the time of day, Thurston says. He's a snooty one.
Hodges starts for the door, and a pain like none he's ever felt before comes out of nowhere, lancing up from his belly all the way to his jawline. It's like being shot by a burning arrow, and he staggers.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
the old man asks, starting around the counter.
"Yeah, I'm fine."
He's far from that.
"Leg cramp from driving. I'll be back for my hat."
With luck, he thinks.
27. "You were in there a long time," Holly says. "I hope you gave them a very good story."
"Subpoena." Hodges doesn't need to say more. They've used the subpoena story more than once. Everyone likes to help as long as they're not the ones being served. "Who called?" Thinking it must have been Jerome to see how they're doing.
"Izzy James. They've had 2 more suicide calls. One attempted and one successful. The attempted was a girl who jumped out of a second-story window. She landed on a snowbank and just broke some bones. The other was a boy who hung himself in his closet. Left a note on his pillow. Just one word, Beth, and a broken heart."
The expedition's wheels spin a little when Hodges drops it into gear and rolls back onto the state road. He has to drive with his low beams on. The brights turn the falling snow into a sparkling white wall.
"We have to do this ourselves," she says. "If it's Brady, no one will ever believe it. He'll pretend to be Babineau and spin some story about how he was scared and ran away."
"And never called the police himself after Library Al shot his wife," Hodges says. "I'm not sure that would hold."
"Maybe not. But what if he can jump to someone else? If he could jump to Babineau, who else could he jump to? We have to do this ourselves, even if it means we end up getting arrested for murder. Do you think that could happen, Bill? Do you? Do you? Do you?"
"We'll worry about it later."
"I'm not sure I could shoot a person. Not even Brady Hartsfield, if he looks like someone else."
He repeats, "We'll worry about it later."
"Fine. Where did you get that hat?"
"Swapped it for my fedora."
"The puffball on top is silly, but it looks warm."
"Do you want it?"
"No. But Bill..."
"Jesus, Holly, what?"
"You look awful."
"Flattery will get you nowhere."
"Be sarcastic. Fine. How far is it to where we're going?"
The general consensus back there was 3.5 miles on this road, then a camp road. Silence for 5 minutes as they creep through the blowing snow. And the main body of the storm is still coming, Hodges reminds himself.
"Bill."
"What now?"
"You have no boots, and I'm all out of Nicorette."
"Spark up one of those joints, why don't you? But keep an eye out for a couple of red posts on the left while you do it. They should be coming up soon."
Holly doesn't light a joint, just sits forward looking to the left. When the expedition skids again, the rear end flirting first left and then right, she doesn't appear to notice. A minute later, she points.
"Is that them?"
It is. The passing plows have buried all but the last 18 inches or so, but that bright red is impossible to miss or mistake. Hodges feathers the brakes, brings the expedition to a stop, then turns it so it's facing the snowbank. He tells Holly what he sometimes used to tell his daughter when he took her on the Wild Cups at Lakewood Amusement Park. "Hold on to your false teeth." Holly, always the literalist, says,
"I don't have any."
But she does put a bracing hand on the dashboard. Hodges steps down gently on the gas and rolls at the snowbank. The thud he expected doesn't come. Thurston was right about the snow not yet having a chance to pack and harden. It explodes away to either side and up onto the windshield, momentarily blinding him. He shoves the wipers into overdrive, and when the glass clears, the expedition is pointing down a 1-lane camp road rapidly filling with snow. Every now and then, more flumps down from the overhanging branches. He sees no tracks from a previous car, but that means nothing. By now, they'd be gone. He kills the headlights and advances at a creep. The band of white between the trees is just visible enough to serve as a guide track. The road seems endless, sloping, switching back, then sloping again. But eventually, they come to the place where it splits left and right. Hodges doesn't have to get out and check the arrows. Ahead on the left, through the snow and the trees, He can see a faint glimmer of light. That's heads and skins, and someone is home. He crimps the wheel and begins rolling slowly down the right-hand fork. Neither of them looks up and sees the video camera, but it sees them.
28. By the time Hodges and Holly burst through the snowbank left by the plow, Brady is sitting in front of the TV, fully dressed in Babineau's winter coat and boots. He's left off the gloves. He wants his hands bare in case he has to use the scar. But there's a black balaclava lying across one thigh. When the time comes, he'll don it to cover Babineau's face and silver hair. His eyes never leave the television as he nervously stirs the pens and pencils sticking out of the ceramic skull. A sharp lookout is absolutely necessary. When Hodges comes, he'll kill his headlights. Will he have the nigger lawn boy with him? Brady wonders. Wouldn't that be sweet? Two for the price of... And there he is. He was afraid the debt wretch's vehicle might get by him in the thickening snow, but that was a needless worry. The snow is white, and the SUV is a solid black rectangle sliding through it. Brady leans forward, squinting, but can't tell if there's only one person in the cabin, or two, or half a fucking dozen. He's got the scar, and with it he could wipe out an entire squad if he had to, but that would spoil the fun. He'd like Hodges alive. To start with, at least. Only one more question needs to be answered. Will he turn left and bore straight in, or right? Brady is betting K. William Hodges will choose the fork that leads to Big Bob's, and he's right. As the SUV disappears into the snow, with a brief flash of the taillights as Hodges negotiates the first turn, Brady puts the skull pin holder down next to the TV remote and picks up an item that has been waiting on the end table. A perfectly legal item when used the right way, which it never was by Babineau and his cohorts. They may have been good doctors, but out here in the woods they were often bad boys. He pulls this valuable piece of equipment over his head and lets it hang against the front of his coat by the elastic strap. Then he pulls on the balaclava, grabs the scar, and heads out. His heart is beating fast and hard, and for the time being at least, the arthritis in Babineau's fingers seems to be completely gone. Payback is a bitch, and the bitch is back. 29. Holly doesn't ask Hodges why he took the right-hand fork. She's neurotic, but not stupid. He drives at a walking pace, looking to his left, measuring the lights to his left. When he's even with them, he stops the SUV and switches off the engine. It's full dark now, and when he turns to look at Holly, she has the fleeting impression that his head has been replaced by a skull. "Stay here," he says in a low voice. "Text Jerome. Tell him we're okay. I'm going to cut through those woods and take him."
"You don't mean alive, do you?"
"Not if I see him with one of those zappets. And probably even if I don't," he thinks. "We can't take the risk."
"Then you believe it's him, Brady?"
"Even if it's Babineau, he's part of this, neck deep in it. But yes, at some point he has become convinced that Brady Hartsfield's mind is now running Babineau's body. The intuition is too strong to deny and has gained the weight of fact. God help me if I kill him and I'm wrong, he thinks. Only how would I know? How could I ever be sure? He expects Holly to protest, to tell him she has to come along, but all she says is,
"I don't think I can drive this thing out of here if something happens to you, Bill."
He hands her Thurston's card. "If I'm not back in 10 minutes, no, make it 15, call this guy."
"What if I hear shots?"
"If it's me and I'm okay, I'll honk the horn of Library Al's car. 2 quick beeps. If you don't hear that, drive the rest of the way to the other camp, Big Bob's What's It. Break in, find somewhere to hide, call Thurston." Hodges leans across the center console and for the first time since he's known her, kisses her lips. She's too startled to kiss him back, but she doesn't pull away. When he does, she looks down in confusion and says the first thing that comes into her mind.
Bill, you're in shoes. You'll freeze.
There's not so much snow in the trees, only a couple of inches, and really cold feet are the least of his worries at this point. He finds the toggle switch that kills the interior lights. As he leaves the expedition, grunting with suppressed pain, she can hear the rising whisper of the wind in the fir trees. If it were a voice, it would be mourning. Then the door shuts. Holly sits where she is, watching his dark shape merge with the dark shapes of the trees. And when she can no longer tell which is which, she gets out and follows his tracks. The Victory 38 that Hodge's father once carried as a beat cop back in the 50s when Sugar Heights was still woodland is in her coat pocket. 30. Hodges makes his way toward the lights of Heads and Skins, one plodding step at a time. Snow flicks his face and coats his eyelids. That burning arrow is back, lighting him up inside, frying him. His face is running with sweat. At least my feet aren't hot, he thinks, and that's when he stumbles over a snow-covered log and goes sprawling. He lands squarely on his left side and buries his face in the arm of his coat to keep from screaming. Hot liquid spills into his crotch. Wet my pants, he thinks. Wet my pants just like a baby. When the pain recedes a little, he gathers his legs under him and tries to stand. He can't do it. The wetness is turning cold. He can actually feel his dick shriveling to get away from it. He grabs a low-hanging branch and tries again to get up. It snaps off. He looks at it stupidly, feeling like a cartoon character. Wile E. Coyote, maybe, and tosses it aside. As he does, a hand hooks into his armpit. His surprise is so great he almost screams. Then Holly is whispering in his ear,
"Upsa-daisy, Bill. Come on."
With her help, he's finally able to make it to his feet. The lights are close now, no more than 40 yards through the screening trees. He can see the snow frosting her hair and lighting on her cheeks. All at once he finds himself remembering the office of an antique book dealer named Andrew Halliday and how he, Holly, and Jerome had discovered Halliday lying dead on the floor. He told them to stay back, but...
Holly, if I told you to go back, would you do it?
No,
she's whispering. They both are.
You'll probably have to shoot him, and you can't get there without help.
You're supposed to be my backup, Holly. My insurance policy.
The sweat is pouring off him like oil. Thank God his coat is a long one. He doesn't want Holly to know he pissed himself.
Jerome is your insurance policy, she says. I'm your partner. That's why you brought me, whether you know it or not. And it's what I want. It's all I ever wanted. Now come on, lean on me. Let's finish this.
They move slowly through the remaining trees. Hodges can't believe how much of his weight she's taking. They pause at the edge of the clearing that surrounds the house. There are two lighted rooms. Judging by the subdued glow coming from the one closest to them, Hodges thinks it must be the kitchen. A single light on in there. Maybe the one over the stove. Coming from the other window, he can make out an unsteady flicker that probably means a fireplace.
That's where we're going, he says, pointing. And from here on, we're soldiers on night patrol, which means we crawl.
Can you?
Yeah.
It might actually be easier than walking.
See the chandelier?
Yes. It looks all bony. Oof.
That's the living room, and that's where he'll probably be. If he's not, we'll wait until he shows. If he's got one of those zappets, I intend to shoot him. No hands up, no lie down, and put your hands behind your back. Do you have a problem with that?
Absolutely not.
They drop to their hands and knees. Hodges leaves the Glock in his coat pocket, not wanting to dunk it in the snow.
Bill,
her whisper so low, He can barely hear it over the rising wind. He turns to look at her. She's holding out one of her gloves. "Too small," he says, and thinks of Johnny Cochran saying, "If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit." Crazy what goes through a person's mind at times like this. Only, has there ever in his life been a time like this? "Force it," she whispers. "You need to keep your gun hand warm." She's right, and he manages to get it most of the way on. It's too short to get over all of his hand, but his fingers are covered, and that's all that matters. They crawl, Hodges slightly in the lead. The pain is still bad, but now that he's off his feet, the arrow in his guts is smoldering rather than burning. Got to save some energy, though, he thinks. Just enough. It's 40 or 50 feet from the edge of the woods to the window with the chandelier hanging in it, and his uncovered hand has lost all feeling by the time they're halfway there. He can't believe he's brought his best friend to this place in this moment, crawling through the snow like children playing a war game miles from any help. He had his reasons, and they made sense back in that airport Hilton. Now, not so much. He looks left, at the silent hulk of Library Al's Malibu. He looks right, and sees a snow-covered woodpile. He starts to look ahead again, at the living room window, then snaps his head back to the woodpile, alarm bells ringing just a little too late. There are tracks in the snow. The angle was wrong to see them from the edge of the woods, but he can see them clearly now. They lead from the back of the house to that stack of fireplace fuel. He came outside through the kitchen door, Hodges thinks. That's why the light was on in there. I should have guessed. I would have, if I hadn't been so sick. He scrabbles for the Glock, but the too small glove slows his grip, and when he finally gets hold of it and tries to pull it out, the gun snags in the pocket. Meanwhile, a dark shape has risen from behind the woodpile. The shape covers the 15 feet between it and them in 4 great looping strides. The face is that of an alien in a horror movie, featureless except for the round, projecting eyes. "Holly, look out!" She lifts her head just as the butt of the scar comes down to meet it. There's a sickening crack, and she drops face first into the snow with her arms thrown out to either side, a puppet with its strings cut. Hodges frees the Glock from his coat pocket just as the butt comes down again. Hodges both feels and hears his wrist break. He sees the Glock land in the snow and almost disappear. Still on his knees, Hodges looks up and sees a tall man, much taller than Brady Hartsfield, standing in front of Holly's motionless form. He's wearing a balaclava and night vision goggles. "He saw us as soon as we came out of the trees," Hodges thinks dully. "For all I know, he saw us in the trees while I was pulling on Holly's glove." "Hello, Detective Hodges." Hodges doesn't reply. He wonders if Holly is still alive, and if she'll ever recover from the blow she's just been dealt, if she is. But of course, that's stupid. Brady isn't going to give her any chance to recover.
"You're coming inside with me," Brady says. "The question is whether or not we bring her, or leave her out here to turn into a popsicle."
And, as if he's read Hodges' mind, for all Hodges knows, he can do that.
"Oh, she's still alive. At least for now. I can see her back going up and down. Although, after a hit that hard, and with her face in the snow, who knows for how long?"
"I'll carry her," Hodges says, and he will, no matter how much it hurts.
"Okay."
No pause to think it over, and Hodges knows it's what Brady expected and what Brady wanted. He's one step ahead, has been all along, and whose fault is that? Mine. Entirely mine. It's what I get for playing the Lone Ranger yet again. But what else could I do? Who would ever have believed it?
"Pick her up," Brady says. "Let's see if you really can. Because, tell you what, you look mighty shaky to me."
Hodges gets his arms under Holly. In the woods, he couldn't make it to his feet after he fell, but now he gathers everything he has left and does a clean and jerk with her limp body. He staggers, almost goes down, and finds his balance again.
The burning arrow is gone, incinerated in the forest fire it has touched off inside him, but he hugs her to his chest.
That's good. Brady sounds genuinely admiring. Now let's see if you can make it to the house.
Somehow, Hodges does.
31. The wood in the fireplace is burning well and throwing a stuporous heat. Gasping for breath, the snow on his borrowed hat melting and running down his face in slushy streams, Hodges gets to the middle of the room and then goes to his knees, having to cradle Holly's neck and the crook of his elbow because of his broken wrist, which is swelling up like a sausage. He manages to keep her head from banging on the hardwood floor, and that's good. Her head has taken enough abuse tonight. Brady has removed his coat, the night vision goggles, and the balaclava. It's Babineau's face and Babineau's silvery hair, now in unaccustomed disarray. But it's Brady Hartsfield, all right. Hodge's last doubts have departed.
Has she got a gun?
No. The man who looks like Felix Babineau smiles.
Well, here's what I'm going to do, Bill. I'll search your pockets, and if I do find a gun, I'll blow her narrow ass into the next state. How's that for a deal?
It's a .38, Hodges says. She's right-handed, so if she brought it, it's probably in the right front pocket of her coat. Brady bends, keeping the scar trained on Hodges as he does so, finger on the trigger and the butt plate braced against the right side of his chest. He finds the revolver, examines it briefly, then tucks it into his belt at the small of his back. In spite of his pain and despair, Hodges feels a certain sour amusement. Brady's probably seen badass dudes do that in 100 TV shows and action movies, but it really only works with automatics, which are flat. On the hooked rug, Holly makes a snoring sound deep in her throat. One foot gives a spastic jerk, then goes still.
What about you? Brady asks. Any other weapons? The ever-popular throwdown gun strapped to your ankle, perhaps?
Hodges shakes his head.
Just to be on the safe side, why don't you hoist up your pants legs for me?
Hodges does it, revealing soaked shoes, wet socks, and nothing else.
Excellent. Now take off your coat and throw it on the couch.
Hodges unzips it and manages to keep quiet while he shrugs out of it, but when he tosses it, a bull's horn gores him from crotch to heart, and he groans. Babineau's eyes widen.
Real pain or fake? Live or Memorex? Judging from a quite striking weight loss, I'm going to say it's real. What's up, Detective Hodges? What's going on with you?
Cancer. Pancreatic.
Oh, goodness, that's bad. Not even Superman can beat that one. But cheer up. I may be able to shorten your suffering.
Do what you want with me, Hodges says. Just let her alone.
Brady looks at the woman on the floor with great interest. This would not, by any chance, be the woman who smashed in what used to be my head, is it?
The locution strikes him funny and he laughs. No. The world has become a camera lens, zooming in and out with every beat of his laboring pacemaker-assisted heart. Holly Gibney was the one who thumped you. She's gone back to live with her parents in Ohio. That's Kara Winston, my assistant. The name comes to him from nowhere, and there's no hesitation as he speaks it.
An assistant who just decided to come with you on a do-or-die mission. I find that a little hard to believe.
I promised her a bonus. She needs the money.
And where, pray tell, is your nigger lawn boy?
Hodges briefly considers telling Brady the truth, that Jerome is back in the city, that he knows Brady has probably gone to the hunting camp, that he will pass this information on to the police soon if he hasn't already, but will any of those things stop Brady? Of course not. Jerome is in Arizona, building houses, Habitat for Humanity.
How socially conscious of him. I was hoping he'd be with you. How badly hurt is his sister?
Broken leg. She'll be up and walking in no time.
That's a shame.
She was one of your test cases, wasn't she?
She got one of the original Zappets.
Yes. There were 12 of them. Like the 12 apostles, you might say, going forth to spread the word. Sit in the chair in front of the TV, Detective Hodges.
I'd rather not. All my favorite shows are on Monday.
Brady smiles politely. Sit.
Hodges sits, bracing his good hand on the table beside the chair. Going down is agony, but once he actually makes it, sitting is a little better. The TV is off, but he stares at it anyway. Where's the camera?
On the signpost where the road splits,
above the arrows. You don't have to feel bad about missing it. It was covered with snow. Nothing sticking out but the lens, and your headlights were off by then.
Is there any Babineau left inside you?
He shrugs. Bits and pieces. Every now and then there's a small scream from the part that thinks it's still alive. It will stop soon.
Jesus, Hodges mutters. Brady drops to one knee, the barrel of the scar resting on his thigh and still pointing at Hodges. He pulls down the back of Holly's coat and examines the tag.
H. Gibney, he says. Printed in indelible ink. Very tidy. Won't wash off in the laundry. I like a person who takes care of her things.
Hodges closes his eyes. The pain is very bad, and he would give everything he owns to get away from it and from what is going to happen next. He would give anything to just sleep and sleep and sleep. But he opens them again and forces himself to look at Brady because you play the game to the end. That's how it works. Play to the end.
I have a lot of stuff to do in the next 48 or 72 hours,
Detective Hodges.
But I'm going to put it on hold in order to deal with you. Does that make you feel special?
It should. Because I owe you so much for fucking me over. You need to remember that you came to me, Hodges says. You were the one who started the ball rolling with that stupid bragging letter, not me, you. Babineau's face, the craggy face of an older character actor, darkens.
I suppose you might have a point, but look who's on top now. Look who wins,
Detective Hodges. If you call getting a bunch of stupid, confused kids to commit suicide winning, I guess you're the winner. Me, I think doing that is about as challenging as striking out the pitcher.
It's control. I assert control. You tried to stop me, and you couldn't. You absolutely couldn't, and neither could she.
He kicks Holly in the side. Her body rolls a boneless half a turn toward the fireplace, then rolls back again. Her face is ashen, her closed eyes sunk deep in their sockets.
She actually made me better. Better than I ever was.
Then for Christ's sake, stop kicking her, Hodges shouts. Brady's anger and excitement have caused Babineau's face to flush. His hands are tight on the assault rifle. He takes a deep, steadying breath, then another, and smiles.
Got a soft spot for Ms. Gibney, do you?
He kicks her again, this time in the hip.
Are you fucking her? Is that it? She's not much in the looks department, but I guess a guy your age has to take what he can get. You know what we used to say? Put a flag over her face and fuck her for old glory.
He kicks Holly again and bares his teeth at Hodges in what he may think is a smile.
You used to ask me if I was fucking my mother, remember? All those visits you made to my room, asking if I was fucking the only person who ever cared a damn for me. Talking about how hot she looked, and was she a hoochie mama? Asking if I was faking, telling me how much you hoped I was suffering, and I just had to sit there and take it.
He's getting ready to kick poor Holly again. To distract him, Hodges says, there was a nurse, Sadie McDonald. Did you nudge her into killing herself? You did, didn't you? She was the first one.
Brady likes that. And shows even more of Babineau's expensive dental work. It was easy. It always is, once you get inside and start pulling the levers.
How do you do that, Brady? How do you get inside? How did you manage to get those zappets from Sunrise Solutions and rig them? Oh, and the website, how about that?
Brady laughs. You've read too many of those mystery stories, where the clever private eye keeps the insane murderer talking until help arrives. Or until the murderer's attention wavers, and the private eye can grapple with him and get his gun away. I don't think help is going to arrive, and you don't look capable of grappling with a goldfish.
Besides, you know most of it already. You wouldn't be here if you didn't. Freddy spilled her guts, and not to sound like Snidely Whiplash, she will pay for that, eventually.
She claimed she didn't set up the website. I didn't need her for that. I did it all by myself in Babineau's study on Babineau's laptop during one of my vacations from room 217.
What about...
Shut up! See that table beside you, Detective Hodges? It's cherry wood like the buffet and looks expensive, but there are faded rings all over it from glasses that were put down without benefit of coasters. The doctors who own this place may be meticulous in operating rooms, but out here they're slobs. On top of it now is the TV remote and a ceramic skull pin holder.
Open the drawer.
Hodges does. Inside is a pink Zappet Commander, sitting on top of an ancient TV guide with Hugh Laurie on the cover.
Take it out and turn it on.
No.
All right, fine. I'll just take care of Ms. Gibney, then.
He lowers the barrel of the scar and points it at the back of Holly's neck.
On full auto, this will rip her head right off. Will it fly into the fireplace? Let's find out.
Okay, Hodges says. Okay, stop. He takes the Zappet and finds the button at the top of the console. The welcome screen lights up. The diagonal downstroke of the red Z fills the screen. He is invited to swipe and access the games. He does so without being prompted by Brady. Sweat pours down his face. He has never been so hot. His broken wrist throbs and pulses.
Do you see the fishing hole icon?
Yes. Opening fishing hole is the last thing he wants to do. But when the alternative is just sitting here with his broken wrist and his swollen, pulsing gut and watching a stream of high-caliber bullets divide Holly's head from her slight body, not an option. And besides, he has read a person can't be hypnotized against his will. It's true that Dinah Scott's console almost put him under, but then he didn't know what was happening. Now he does. And if Brady thinks he's tranced out, and he's not, then maybe, just maybe.
I'm sure you know the drill by now,
Brady says. His eyes are bright and lively, the eyes of a boy who's about to set a spider web on fire so he can see what the spider will do. Will it scurry around its flaming web looking for a way to escape, or will it just burn?
Tap the icon. The fish will swim, and the music will play. Tap the pink fish and add up the numbers. In order to win the game, you have to score 120 points in 120 seconds. If you succeed, I'll let Ms. Gibney live. If you fail, we'll see what this fine automatic weapon can do.
Babineau saw it demolish a stack of concrete blocks once, so just imagine what it will do to flesh.
You're not going to let her live even if I score 5,000, Hodges says. I don't believe that for a second.
Babineau's blue eyes widen in mock outrage.
But you should. All that I am, I owe to this bitch sprawled out in front of me. The least I can do is spare her life. Assuming she isn't suffering a brain bleed and dying already, that is.
Now stop playing for time. Play the game instead. Your 120-second start as soon as your finger taps the icon.
With no other recourse, Hodges taps it. The screen blanks. There's a blue flash so bright it makes him squint. And then the fish are there, swimming back and forth, up and down, crisscrossing, sending up silvery trails of bubbles. The music begins to tinkle.
By the sea, by the beautiful sea.
Only it isn't just music.
There are words mixed in, and there are words in the blue flashes, too.
10 seconds gone, Brady says. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Hodges taps at one of the pink fish and misses. He's right-hand dominant, and each tap makes the throbbing in his wrist that much worse, but the pain there is nothing compared to the pain now roasting him from groin to throat. On his third try, he gets a pinky. That's how he thinks of them, as pinkies. And the fish turns into a number 5. He says it out loud.
Only 5 points in 20 seconds? Brady says. Better step it up, detective.
Hodges taps faster, eyes moving left and right, up and down. He no longer has to squint when the blue flashes come because he's used to them. And it's getting easier. The fish seem bigger now, also a little slower. The music seems less tinkly, fuller somehow.
You and me, you and me, oh how happy we'll be.
Is that Brady's voice singing along with the music or just his imagination? Live or Memorex? No time to think about it now. Tempus is fugiting. He gets a 7 fish, then a 4, and then jackpot. 1 turns into a 12. He says, I'm up to 27. But is that right? He's losing count. Brady doesn't tell him. Brady only says,
80 seconds to go.
And now his voice seems to have picked up a slight echo as if it's coming to Hodges from the far end of a long hallway. Meanwhile, a marvelous thing is happening. The pain in his gut is starting to recede. Whoa, he thinks. The AMA should know about this. He gets another pinky. It turns into a 2. Not so good, but there are plenty more. Plenty, plenty more. That's when he starts to feel something like fingers fluttering delicately inside his head. And it's not his imagination. He's being invaded.
It was easy, Brady said of Nurse McDonald. It always is, once you get inside and start pulling the levers.
And when Brady gets to his levers, he'll jump inside me the way he jumped inside Babineau, Hodges thinks. Although this realization is now like the voice and the music coming from the far end of a long hallway. At the end of that hallway is the door to room 217, and the door is standing open. Why would he want to do that? Why would he want to inhabit a body that's turned into a cancer factory? Because he wants me to kill Holly. Not with the gun, though. He'd never trust me with that. He'll use my hands to choke her, broken wrist and all. Then he'll leave me to face what I've done.
You're getting better, Detective Hodges, and you still have a minute to go. Just relax and keep tapping. It's easier when you relax.
The voice is no longer echoing down a hallway. Even though Brady is now standing right in front of him, it's coming from a galaxy far, far away. Brady bends down and stares eagerly into Hodges' face. Only there are fish swimming between them. Pinkies and blueies and reddies. Because Hodges is in the fishing hole now. Except it's really an aquarium, and he's the fish. Soon he will be eaten. Eaten alive.
Come on, Billy boy. Tap those pink fish.
I can't let him inside me, Hodges thinks. But I can't keep him out. He taps a pink fish. It turns into a 9. And it isn't just fingers he feels now, but another consciousness spilling into his mind. It's spreading like ink in water. Hodges tries to fight and knows he will lose. The strength of that invading personality is incredible. I'm going to drown. Drown in the fishing hole. Drown in Brady Hart's field.
By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea.
A pane of glass shatters close by. It's followed by a jubilant chorus of boys shouting, "That's a home run!" The bond binding Hodges to Hartsfield is broken by the pure, unexpected surprise of the thing. Hodges jerks back in the chair and looks up as Brady wheels toward the couch,
eyes wide and mouth open in startlement. The Victory 38, held against the small of his back only by its short barrel, the cylinder won't allow it to go deeper, falls out of his belt and thumps to the bearskin rug. Hodges doesn't hesitate. He throws the Zappit into the fireplace.
"Don't you do that!"
Brady bellows, turning back. He raises the scar.
"Don't you fucking dare!"
Hodges grasps the nearest thing to hand, not the 38, but the ceramic pin holder. There's nothing wrong with his left wrist, and the range is short. He throws it at the face Brady has stolen. He throws it hard and connects dead center. The ceramic skull shatters. Brady screams. Pain, yes, but mostly shock. And his nose begins to gush blood. When he tries to bring up the scar, Hodges pistons out his feet, enduring another deep gore of that bull's horn, and smashes them into Brady's chest. Brady backpedals, almost catches his balance, then trips over a hassock and sprawls on the bearskin rug. Hodges tries to launch himself out of the chair and only succeeds in overturning the end table. He goes to his knees as Brady sits up, bringing the scar around. There's a gunshot before he can level it on Hodges, and Brady screams again. This time it's all pain. He looks unbelievingly at his shoulder where blood is pouring through a hole in his shirt. Holly is sitting up. There's a grotesque bruise over her left eye in almost the same place as the one on Freddy's forehead. That left eye is red, filled with blood, but the other is bright and aware. She's holding the Victory 38 in both hands.
"Shoot him again!" Hodges roars. "Shoot him again, Holly!"
As Brady lurches to his feet, one hand clapped to the wound in his shoulder, the other holding the scar, face slack with disbelief, Holly fires again. This bullet goes way high, ricocheting off the field stone chimney above the roaring fire.
"Stop that!"
Brady shouts, ducking. At the same time, he's struggling to raise the scar.
"Stop doing that, you bit!"
Holly fires a third time. The sleeve of Brady's shirt twitches and he yelps. Hodges isn't sure she's winged him again, but she at least grooved him. Hodges gets to his feet and tries to run at Brady, who is making another effort to raise the automatic rifle. The best he can manage is a slow plod.
"You're in the way," Holly cries. "Bill, you're in the fracking way."
Hodges drops to his knees and tucks his head. Brady turns and runs. The 38 bangs. Wood splinters fly from the doorframe a foot to Brady's right. Then he's gone. The front door opens, cold air rushes in, making the fire do an excited shimmy.
"I missed him,"
Holly shouts, agonized.
"Stupid and useless, stupid and useless."
She drops the Victory and slaps herself across the face. Hodges catches her hand before she can do it again and kneels beside her. "No, you got him at least once, maybe twice. You're the reason we're still alive. But for how long?" Brady held on to that goddamn grease gun. He may have an extra clip or two, and Hodges knows he wasn't lying about the Scar 17S's ability to demolish concrete blocks. He has seen a similar assault rifle, the HK-416, do exactly that at a private shooting facility in the wilds of Victory County. He went there with Pete, and on the way back they joked about how the HK should be standard police issue.
"What do we do?"
Holly asks.
"What do we do now?"
Hodges picks up the 38 and rolls the barrel. Two rounds left, and the 38 is only good at short range anyway. Holly has a concussion at the very least, and he's almost incapacitated. The bitter truth is this. They had a chance, and Brady got away. He hugs her and says, "I don't know."
"Maybe we should hide."
"I don't think that would work," he says, but doesn't say why, and is relieved when she doesn't ask. It's because there's still a little of Brady left inside of him. It probably won't last long, but for the time being, at least, Hodges suspects it's as good as a homing beacon.
32. Brady staggers through shin-deep snow, eyes wide with disbelief. Babineau's 63-year-old heart banging away in his chest. There's a metallic taste on his tongue. His shoulder is burning. And the thought running through his head on a constant loop is, that bitch, that dirty sneaking bitch. Why didn't I kill her while I had the chance? The Zappit is gone too. Good old Zappit Zero. And it's the only one he brought. Without it, he has no way to reach the minds of those with active Zappits. He stands panting in front of heads and skins, coatless in the rising wind and driving snow. The keys to Z-Boy's car are in his pocket, along with another clip for the scar. But what good are the keys? That shitbox wouldn't make it halfway up the first hill before it got stuck.
I have to take them, he thinks, and not just because they owe me. The SUV Hodges drove down here is the only way out of here, and either he or the bitch probably has the keys. It's possible they left them in the vehicle, but that's a chance I can't afford to take. Besides, it would mean leaving them alive. He knows what he has to do, and switches the fire control to full auto. He socks the butt of the scar against his good shoulder and starts shooting, raking the barrel from left to right, but concentrating on the great room where he left them. Gunfire lights up the night, turning the fast-falling snow into a series of flash photographs. The sound of the overlapping reports is deafening. Windows explode inward. Clapboards rise from the facade like bats. The front door left half open and his escape flies all the way back, rebounds, and is driven back again. Babineau's face is twisted in an expression of joyful hate that is all Brady Hartsfield, and he doesn't hear the growl of an approaching engine or the clatter of steel treads from behind him.
33.
Down, Hodges shouts. Holly, down! He doesn't wait to see if she'll obey on her own, just lands on top of her and covers her body with his. Above them, the living room is a storm of flying splinters, broken glass, and chips of rock from the chimney. An elk's head falls off the wall and lands on the hearth. One glass eye has been shattered by a Winchester slug, and it looks like it's winking at them. Holly screams. Half a dozen bottles on the buffet explode, releasing the stench of bourbon and gin. A slug strikes a burning log in the fireplace, bursting it in two and sending up a storm of sparks. Please let him just have the one clip, Hodges thinks. And if he aims low, let him hit me instead of Holly. Only a .308 Winchester slug that hits him will go through them both, and he knows it. The gunfire stops. Is he reloading, or is he out? Live or Memorex?
Bill, get off me. I can't breathe.
Better not, he says.
What's that? What's that sound?
And then, answering her own question,
someone's coming.
Now that his ears are clearing a little, Hodges can hear it too. At first he thinks it must be Thurston's grandson on one of the snowmobiles the old man mentioned, and about to be slaughtered for trying to play Good Samaritan. But maybe not. The approaching engine sounds too heavy for a snowmobile. Bright yellow-white light floods in through the shattered windows like the spotlights from a police helicopter. Only this is no helicopter.
34. Brady is ramming his extra clip home when he finally registers the growl and clank of the approaching vehicle. He whirls, wounded shoulder throbbing like an infected tooth, just as a huge silhouette appears at the end of the camp road. The headlamps dazzle him. His shadow leaps out long on the sparkling snow as the whatever it is comes rolling toward the shot-up house, throwing gouts of snow behind its clanking treads. And it's not just coming at the house. It's coming at him. He depresses the trigger and the scar resumes its thunder. Now he can see it's some kind of snow machine with a bright orange cabin sitting high above the churning treads. The windshield explodes just as someone dives for safety from the open driver's side door. The monstrosity keeps coming. Brady tries to run and Babineau's expensive loafers slip. He flails, staring at those oncoming headlights, and goes down on his back. The orange invader rises above him. He sees a steel tread whirring toward him. He tries to push it away, as he sometimes pushed objects in his room, the blinds, the bedclothes, the door to the bathroom. But it's like trying to beat off a charging lion with a toothbrush. He raises a hand and draws in breath to scream. Before he can, the left tread of the Tucker Snowcat rolls over his midsection and chews it open. 35. Holly has zero doubt concerning the identity of their rescuer and doesn't hesitate. She runs through the bullet-pocked foyer and out the front door, crying his name over and over. Jerome looks as if he's been dusted in powdered sugar when he picks himself up. She's sobbing and laughing as she throws herself into his arms.
How did you know? How did you know to come?
I didn't, he says. It was Barbara. When I called to say I was coming home, she told me I had to go after you or Brady would kill you. Only she called him the voice. She was half crazy.
Hodges is making his way toward the two of them at a slow stagger, but he's close enough to overhear this and remembers that Barbara told Holly some of that suicide voice was still inside her, like a trail of slime, she said. Hodges knows what she was talking about because he's got some of that disgusting thought snot in his own head, at least for the time being. Maybe Barbara had just enough of a connection to know that Brady was lying in wait. Or hell, maybe it was pure woman's intuition. Hodges actually believes in such a thing. He's old school. Jerome, he says. The word comes out in a dusty croak. My man. His knees unlock. He's going down. Jerome frees himself from Holly's death grip and puts an arm around Hodges before he can. Are you all right? I mean, I know you're not all right, but are you shot? No, Hodges puts his own arm around Holly. And I should have known you'd come. Neither one of your minds worth a tinker's damn.
Couldn't break up the band before the final reunion concert, could we? Jerome says. Let's get you in the...
There comes an animal sound from their left. A guttural groan that struggles to be words and can't make it. Hodges is more exhausted than ever in his life, but he walks toward that groan anyway because... Well, because... What was the word he used with Holly on their way out here? Closure, wasn't it? Brady's hijacked body has been laid open to the backbone. His guts are spread out around him like the wings of a red dragon. Pools of steaming blood are sinking into the snow. But his eyes are open and aware, and all at once Hodges can feel those fingers again. This time they're not just probing lazily. This time they're frantic, scrabbling for purchase. Hodges ejects them as easily as that floor-mopping orderly once pushed this man's presence out of his mind. He spits Brady out like a watermelon seed.
Help me, Brady whispers. You have to help me.
I think you're way beyond help, Hodges says. You were run down, Brady. Run down by an extremely heavy vehicle. Now you know what that feels like, don't you?
Hurts,
Brady whispers. Yes, Hodges says. I imagine it does.
If you can't help me, shoot me.
Hodges holds out his hand, and Holly puts the Victory 38 into it like a nurse handing a doctor a scalpel. He rolls the cylinder and dumps out one of the two remaining bullets. Then he closes the gun up again. Although he hurts everywhere now, hurts like hell, Hodges kneels down and puts his father's gun in Brady's hand. You do it, he says. It's what you always wanted. Jerome stands by, ready in case Brady should decide to use that final round on Hodges instead. But he doesn't. Brady tries to point the gun at his head. He can't. His arm twitches, but won't rise. He groans again. Blood pours over his lower lip and seeps out from between Felix Babineau's capped teeth. It would almost be possible to feel sorry for him, Hodges thinks, if you didn't know what he did at City Center, what he tried to do at the Mingo Auditorium, and the suicide machine he set in motion today. That machine will slow down and stop now that its prime operative is finished, but it will swallow up a few more sad young people before it does. Hodges is pretty sure of that. Suicide may not be painless, but it is catching. You could feel sorry for him if he wasn't a monster, Hodges thinks.
Holly kneels, lifts Brady's hand, and puts the muzzle of the gun against his temple. Now, Mr. Hartsfield, she says, you have to do the rest yourself, and may God have mercy on your soul.
I hope not, Jerome says, in the glare of the snowcat's headlights. His face is a stone. For a long moment, the only sounds are the rumble of the snow machine's big engine and the rising wind of Winter Storm Eugenie.
Holly says, Oh God, his finger's not even on the trigger.
One of you needs to help me. I don't think I can.
Then, a gunshot. Brady's last trick, Jerome says. Jesus.
36. There's no way Hodges can make it back to the expedition, but Jerome is able to muscle him into the cab of the Snowcat. Holly sits beside him on the outside. Jerome climbs behind the wheel and throws it into gear. Although he backs up and then circles wide around the remains of Babineau's body, he tells Holly not to look until they're at least up the first hill.
We're leaving blood tracks.
Oof.
Correct, Jerome says.
Oof is correct. Thurston told me he had snowmobiles, Hodges says. He didn't mention anything about a Sherman tank.
It's a Tucker Snowcat, and you didn't offer him your MasterCard as collateral. Not to mention an excellent Jeep Wrangler that got me out here to the Willywags just fine, thanks.
Is he really dead?
Holly asks. Her wan face is turned up to Hodges, and the huge knot on her forehead actually seems to be pulsing.
Really? And for sure?
You saw him put a bullet in his brain.
Yes, but is he? Really? And for sure?
The answer he won't give is no, not yet. Not until the trails of slime he's left in the heads of God knows how many people are washed away by the brain's remarkable ability to heal itself. But in another week, another month at the outside, Brady will be all gone. Yes, he says. And Holly, thanks for programming that text alert, the home run, boys.
She smiles. What was it? The text, I mean.
Hodges struggles his phone out of his coat pocket, checks it, and says, I will be goddamned. He begins to laugh. I completely forgot.
What? Show me, show me, show me.
He tilts the phone so she can read the text his daughter Allison has sent him from California, where the sun is no doubt shining.
Happy birthday, Daddy. 70 years old and still going strong. I'm rushing out to the market. We'll call you later. XXX Allie.
For the first time since Jerome returned from Arizona, Tyrone Feelgood Delight makes an appearance.
You is 70 years old, Massa Hodges? Laws, you don't look a day over 65.
Stop it, Jerome, Holly says. I know it amuses you, but that sort of talk sounds very ignorant and silly.
Hodges laughs. It hurts to laugh, but he can't help it. He holds on to consciousness all the way back to Thurston's garage, is even able to take a few shallow tokes on the joint Holly lights and passes to him. Then the dark begins to slip in. This could be it, he thinks. Happy birthday to me, he thinks. Then he's gone.
After. 4 days later.
Pete Huntley is far less familiar with Kiner Memorial than his old partner, who made many pilgrimages here to visit a long-term resident who has now passed away. It takes Pete 2 stops, one at the main desk and one in oncology, before he locates Hodges' room, and when he gets there, it's empty. A cluster of balloons with Happy Birthday Dad on them are tethered to one of the side rails and floating near the ceiling. A nurse pokes her head in, sees him looking at the empty bed, and gives him a smile.
The solarium at the end of the hall. They've been having a little party. I think you're still in time.
Pete walks down. The solarium is skylighted and filled with plants, maybe to cheer up the patients, maybe to provide them with a little extra oxygen, maybe both. Near one wall, a party of 4 is playing cards. 2 of them are bald, and 1 has an IV drip running into his arm. Hodges is seated directly under the skylight, doling out slices of cake to his posse, Holly, Jerome, and Barbara. Kermit seems to be growing a beard. It's coming in snow white, and Pete has a brief memory of going to the mall with his own kids to see Santa Claus.
Pete, Hodges says, smiling. He starts to get up, and Pete waves him back into his seat. Sit down. Have some cake. Allie brought it from Batul's Bakery. It was always her favorite place to go when she was growing up.
Where is she? Pete asks, dragging a chair over and placing it next to Holly. She's sporting a bandage on the left side of her forehead, and Barbara has a cast on her leg. Only Jerome looks hale and hearty,
and Pete knows the kid barely escaped getting turned into hamburger out at that hunting camp. She went back to the coast this morning. 2 days off was all she could manage. She's got 3 weeks vacation coming in March and says she'll be back, if I need her, that is. How are you feeling? Not bad, Hodges says. His eyes flick up and to the left, but only for a second. I've got 3 cancer docs on my case, and the first test came back looking good. That's fantastic. Pete takes the piece of cake Hodges is holding out. This is too big.
Man up and chow down, Hodges says. Listen, about you and Izzy.
We worked it out, Pete says. He takes a bite. Hey, nice. There's nothing like carrot cake with cream cheese frosting to cheer up your blood sugar.
So the retirement party is
back on. Officially, it was never off. I'm still counting on you to give the first toast, and remember...
Yeah, ex-wife and current squeeze both there, nothing too off-color, got it.
Just as long as we're clear on that.
The too big slice of cake is getting smaller. Barbara watches the rapid intake with fascination.
Are we in trouble?
Holly asks.
Are we, Pete, are we?
Nope, Pete says, completely in the clear. That's mostly what I came to tell you.
Holly sits back with a sigh of relief that blows the graying bangs off her forehead.
Bet they've got Babineau carrying the can for everything, Jerome says. Pete points his plastic fork at Jerome. Truth you speak, young Jedi warrior.
You might be interested to know that the famous puppeteer Frank Oz did Yoda's voice, Holly says. She looks around. Well, I find it interesting.
I find this cake interesting, Pete says.
Could I have a little more? Maybe just a sliver?
Barbara does the honors, and it's far more than a sliver, but Pete doesn't object. He takes a bite and asks how she's doing.
Good, Jerome says before she can answer. She's got a boyfriend, kid named Derice Neville, big basketball star.
Shut up, Jerome. He's not my boyfriend.
He sure visits like a boyfriend, Jerome says. I'm talking every day since you broke your leg.
We have a lot to talk about,
Barbara says in a dignified tone of voice.
Pete says, going back to Babineau, hospital administration has some security footage of him coming in through a back entrance on the night his wife was murdered. He changed into maintenance worker duds, probably raided a locker. He leaves, comes back 15 or 20 minutes later, changes back into the clothes he came in, leaves for good.
No other footage? Hodges asks. Like in the bucket?
Yeah, some, but you can't see his face in that stuff because he's wearing a groundhog's cap. And you don't see him go into Hartsfield's room. A defense lawyer might be able to make something of that stuff, but since Babineau's never going to stand trial,
no one gives much of a shit, Hodges finishes.
Correct. City and state cops are delighted to let him carry the weight. Izzy's happy, and so am I. I could ask you, just between us chickens, if it was actually Babineau who died out there in the woods, but I don't really want to know.
So how does Library Al fit into this scenario, Hodges asks.
He doesn't, Pete puts his paper plate aside. Alvin Brooks killed himself last night.
Oh, Christ, Hodges says. While he was in county?
Yes.
They didn't have him on suicide watch after all this?
They did, and none of the inmates are supposed to have anything capable of cutting or stabbing, but he got hold of a ballpoint pen somehow. Might have been a guard who gave it to him. But it was probably another inmate. He drew Z's all over the walls, all over his bunk, and all over himself. Then he took the pen's metal cartridge out of the barrel and used it to...
Stop, Barbara says. She looks very pale in the winter light falling on them from above. We get the idea.
Hodges says. So the thinking is, what, he was Babineau's accomplice? Fell under his influence, Pete says. Or maybe both of them fell under someone else's influence, but let's not go there, okay?
The thing to concentrate on now is that the three of you are in the clear. There won't be any citations this time or city freebies.
It's okay, Jerome says. Me and Holly have still got at least 4 years left on our bus passes anyway. Not that you ever use yours now that you're hardly ever here, Barbara says. You should give it to me.
It's non-transferable, Jerome says smugly. I better hold on to it. Wouldn't want you to get in any trouble with the law. Besides... Soon you'll be going places with Derice. Just don't go too far, if you know what I mean.
You're being childish, Barbara turns to Pete. How many suicides were there in all?
Pete sighs.
14 over the last 5 days. 9 of them had zappets, which are now as dead as their owners. The oldest was 24, the youngest 13. One was a boy from a family that was, according to the neighbors, fairly weird about religion, the kind that makes fundamentalist Christians look liberal. He took his parents and kid brother with him, shotgun. The 5 of them fall silent for a moment. At the table on the left, the card players burst into howls of laughter over something. Pete breaks the silence. And there have been over 40 attempts. Jerome whistles. Yeah, I know. It's not in the papers, and the TV stations are sitting on it. Even Murder and Mayhem. This is a police nickname for WKMM, an indie station that has taken If It Bleeds, It Leads as an article of faith. But of course, a lot of those attempts, maybe even most of them, end up getting blabbed about on the social media sites, and that breeds still more. I hate those sites. But this will settle. Suicide clusters always do. Eventually, Hodges says. But with social media or without it, with Brady or without him, suicide is a fact of life. He looks over at the card players as he says this, especially the 2 baldies. One looks good, as Hodges himself looks good, but the other is cadaverous and hollow-eyed. 1 foot in the grave, and the other on a banana peel, Hodges' father would have said. And the thought that comes to him is too complicated, too fraught with a terrible mixture of anger and sorrow to be articulated. It's about how some people carelessly squander what others would sell their souls to have. A healthy, pain-free body. And why? Because they're too blind, too emotionally scarred, or too self-involved to see past the Earth's dark curve to the next sunrise, which always comes if one continues to draw breath. More cake? Barbara asks. Nope, got a split, but I will sign your cast, if I may. Please, Barbara says, and write something witty. That's far beyond Pete's pay grade, Hodges says. Watch your mouth, Kermit. Pete drops to one knee like a swain about to propose and begins writing carefully on Barbara's cast. When he's finished, he stands up and looks at Hodges. Now tell me the truth about how you're feeling. Damn good. I've got a patch that controls the pain a lot better than the pills, and they're kicking me loose tomorrow. I can't wait to sleep in my own bed. He pauses, then says, I'm going to beat this thing. Pete's waiting for the elevator when Holly catches up to him.
It meant a lot to Bill, she says, that you came, and that you still want to give him that toast.
It's not so good, is it? Pete says.
No.
He reaches out to hug her, but Holly steps back.
She does allow him to take her hand and give it a brief squeeze.
Not so good.
Crap.
Yes, crap. Crap is right. He doesn't deserve this. But since he's stuck with it, he needs his friends to stand by him. You will, won't you?
Of course I will. And don't count him out yet, Holly. Where there's life, there's hope. I know it's a cliché, but... He shrugs.
I do have hope. I have Holly hope.
You can't say she's as weird as ever, Pete thinks, but she's still peculiar. He sort of likes it, actually. Just make sure he keeps that toast relatively clean, okay?
I will.
And hey, he outlived Hartsfield. No matter what else happens, he's got that.
We'll always have Paris, kid,
Holly says in a Bogart drawl. Yes, she's still peculiar. One of a kind, actually.
Listen, Gibney, you need to take care of yourself, too, no matter what happens.
He'd hate it if you didn't.
I know, Holly says, and goes back to the solarium, where she and Jerome will clean up the remains of the birthday party. She tells herself that it isn't necessarily the last one, and tries to convince herself of that. She doesn't entirely succeed, but she continues to have Holly hope.
8 months later. When Jerome shows up at Fairlawn, 2 days after the funeral and at 10 on the dot, as promised, Holly is already there, on her knees at the head of the grave. She's not praying, she's planting a chrysanthemum.
She doesn't look up when his shadow falls over her. She knows who it is. This was the arrangement they made after she told him she didn't know if she could make it all the way through the funeral.
I'll try, she said, but I'm not good with those fracking things. I may have to book. You plant these in the fall, she says now. I don't know much about plants, so I got a how-to guide. The writing was only so-so, but the directions are easy to follow.
That's good. Jerome sits down cross-legged at the end of the plot where the grass begins. Holly scoops dirt carefully with her hands, still not looking at him.
I told you I might have to book. They all stared at me when I left, but I just couldn't stay. If I had, they would have wanted me to stand up there in front of the coffin and talk about him, and I couldn't. Not in front of all those people. I bet his daughter is mad.
Probably not, Jerome says.
I hate funerals. I came to the city for one. Did you know that?
Jerome does, but says nothing, just lets her finish.
My aunt died. She was Olivia Trelawney's mother. That's where I met Bill, at that funeral. I ran out of that one, too. I was sitting behind the funeral parlor, smoking a cigarette, feeling terrible. And that's where he found me. Do you understand? At last she looks up at him. He found me.
I get it, Holly. I do.
He opened a door for me, went into the world. He gave me something to do that made a difference.
Same here. She wipes her eyes almost angrily.
This is just so fracking poopy.
Got that right, but he wouldn't want you to go backward. That's the last thing he'd want.
I won't, she says. You know he left me the company, right? The insurance money and everything else went to Allie, but the company is mine. I can't run it by myself, so I asked Pete if he'd like to work for me, just part-time.
And he said?
He said yes, because retirement sucked already. It should be okay. I'll run down the skippers and deadbeats on my computer, and he'll go out and get them. Or serve the subpoenas, if that's the job. But it won't be like it was. Working for Bill. Working with Bill. Those were the happiest days of my life.
She thinks that over.
I guess the only happy days of my life. I felt, I don't know.
Valued, Jerome suggests.
Yes, valued.
You should have felt that way, Jerome says, because you were very valuable, and still are. She gives the plant a final critical look, dusts dirt from her hands and the knees of her pants, and sits down next to him.
He was brave, wasn't he? At the end, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
She smiles a little.
That's what Bill would have said. Not yes, but yeah.
Yeah, he agrees.
Jerome, would you put your arm around me?
He does.
The first time I met you, when we found the stealth program Brady loaded into my cousin Olivia's computer, I was afraid of you.
I know, Jerome says.
Not because you were black.
Black is whack, Jerome says, smiling. I think we agreed on that much right from the jump.
But because you were a stranger. You were from outside. I was scared of outside people and outside things. I still am, but not as much as I was then.
I know.
I loved him,
Holly says, looking at the chrysanthemum. It is a brilliant orange-red below the gray gravestone, which bears a simple message, Kermit William Hodges. And below the dates, end of watch.
I loved him so much.
Yeah, Jerome says. So did I. She looks up at him, her face timid and hopeful. Beneath the graying bangs, it is almost the face of a child.
You'll always be my friend, won't you?
Always. He squeezes her shoulders, which are heartbreakingly thin, During Hodges' final 2 months, she lost 10 pounds she couldn't afford to lose. He knows his mother and Barbara are just waiting to feed her up. Always, Holly.
I know, she says.
Then why did you ask?
Because it's so good to hear you say it.
End of watch, Jerome thinks. He hates the sound of that, but it's right. It's right. And this is better than the funeral. Being here with Holly on this sunny late summer morning is much better.
Jerome, I'm not smoking.
That's good. They sit quiet for a little while, looking at the chrysanthemum burning its colors at the base of the headstone.
Jerome?
What, Holly?
Would you like to go to a movie with me?
Yes, he says, then corrects himself. Yeah?
We'll leave a seat empty between us, just to put our popcorn in.
Okay.
Because I hate putting it on the floor, where there are probably roaches and maybe even rats.
I hate it, too. What do you want to see?
Something that will make us laugh and laugh.
Works for me. He smiles at her. Holly smiles back. They leave Fairlawn and walk back out into the world together. August 30th, 2015. One last thing from Stephen King. End of watch is fiction, but the high rate of suicides, both in the United States and in many other countries where these books are read, is all too real. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline number given in this book is also real. It's 1-800-273-TALK. If you are feeling poopy, as Holly Gibney would say, give them a call, because things can get better, and if you give them a chance, they usually do. Stephen King.